don't know about you, but I've always had trouble with that text about turning the other cheek. Seems to make Christians into such doormats, doesn't it? And whatever people do to you, however they abuse you, you must just lie down and take it. It's an ethic fit only for cowards and masochists, surely. In fact, you know, that was precisely the complaint of a very famous anti-Christian philosopher, whom actually we quoted a little while ago in connection with Living Dangerously, Nietzsche. Remember him? As far as Nietzsche was concerned, Christianity had emasculated Western civilization by turning weakness and suffering into virtues. The real hero, said Nietzsche, would never sentimentalize about turning the other cheek. No, the real hero is aggressive, he's determined, he's masterful. He's a glorious champion, never a pathetic victim. Only the emergence of a race of such supermen, in his view, could save Europe from what he regarded as a kind of cultural pernicious anemia with which Christianity had infected it. I think it's obvious to any unbiased reader of Nietzsche's essays that he goes too far in his rejection of Christian values. His Superman actually has something rather cruel, even bestial about it. Some people reckon that 20th century fascism in some way originates from this morally perverted dream of a savage master race that Nietzsche propounds. But I must say, I can't help feeling some measure of sympathy for Nietzsche's basic problem. Jesus says, "Blessed are the meek." But how do you distinguish meekness from weakness? He praised the humble-minded, but how do you distinguish humility from servility? If we make turning the other cheek into a consistent policy, then surely there's some truth in Nietzsche's accusation that we should all be reduced to a groveling slavishness of spirit, which is so self-depreciating and submissive as to be utterly contemptible. Now, there's a balance to be struck in this matter, isn't there? We may not admire Nietzsche's Superman, but then Dickens's Uriah Heep isn't much better. The problem is, how do you avoid the one without becoming the other? Well, I think the Apostle Paul this morning has some help to offer us in that dilemma. So we take up his adventure story again. You see, he's arrested by the Roman militia after that riot in Jerusalem we were reading about last week. And at this point in his story, there seems every chance that things are going to end rather abruptly and tragically for him. He is on trial for his life. Now, I suppose a pedantic application of turn the other cheek might lead us to suppose that Paul would demonstrate an unresisting, martyr-like spirit in this situation. Like a good Christian doormat, he would lie down and let his enemies trample all over him, gladly sharpening the executioner's sword if he asked him to. But that is not, in fact, what we find, is it? On the contrary, there is a manliness, there is a dignity, there is almost a pugnacity in the way that Paul conducts himself before the authorities. Not so much of the fawning spaniel as the defiant bulldog is Paul in these chapters. I want us this morning then to identify two things which I think lie behind the apostle's audacious attitude. And I want us, among other things, to see how that fits in with those words of Jesus about turning the other cheek. So two subjects for us to look at in our study this morning. First, I've called the legitimacy of self-defense. And the second I've called the power of plain speaking. All right, let's look at the first. The legitimacy of self-defense. And we go back to Acts 23 again. Verses 1 and 2. Paul looked straight at the Sanhedrin. See, there's aggression even in that, isn't there? My brothers, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all good conscience to this day. Well, this the high priest Ananias ordered those standing near Paul to strike him on the mouth. Now, you would have thought that this was a classic opportunity for an absolutely literal application of turning the other cheek, wouldn't you? Well, the mouth is near enough to the cheek, isn't it? Paul has been arraigned by the Roman commander before the Supreme Jewish Council. He begins his defense speech by pleading not guilty to all charges. I fulfilled my conscience to this day, he says. And the high priest orders him to be slapped, presumably for insolence. Well, surely the right Christian response would have been silent acceptance of this indignity. Turn the other cheek, Paul. And that isn't Paul's response at all, is it? Look what he does in verse 3. Then Paul said to him, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. Commentators have been very vocal in expressing their disapproval of the apostle's belligerence here. And I suppose superficially, at any rate, Paul seems to confirm their criticism by at least appearing to apologize for the ill-judged remark. How dare you insult God's high priest, they say. Paul replies, brothers, I didn't realize he was the high priest, for it is written, don't speak evil about the ruler of your people. However, I'm not sure that apology is quite as straightforward an apology as it seems. Because I have a considerable problem in understanding what Paul meant when he said, I didn't realize he was the high priest. See, in first century Judea, that's a bit like throwing an egg at Margaret Thatcher and then telling the policeman you didn't realize she was the prime minister. The high priest was the most influential and important person in Jewish society. Now, it's true Paul had been out of the country, and they didn't have newspapers and newspaper photographs in those days, so I suppose it's possible he didn't know what he looked like. But on the other hand, we know from contemporary sources that Ananias wasn't a recent appointment to the primate's office. He'd held this job of high priest for at least 10 years. And without doubt, he must have been a prominent figure in local politics in Jerusalem long before that. In fact, it is far from unlikely that Paul and Ananias had known one another, at least as passing acquaintances, in the days before Paul's conversion. For they both came from famous families. Quite apart from the fact, then, that Ananias would almost certainly have worn some insignia of office and occupied some special seat in the assembly, which would have made it obvious who he was, it is intrinsically unlikely that Paul didn't know him. So how could Paul expect anyone to take him seriously when he says, I didn't realize he was the high priest? Well, in my view, there are only two explanations that really have any degree of credibility to my mind. The first is that Paul's eyesight was exceedingly bad. Now, that may not be quite as remote a possibility as it sounds. But on the other is, and this I judge to be more likely, that he was in fact speaking sarcastically here, rather than apologetically. As if to say, oops, sorry. I didn't believe a high priest could behave in such an outrageous manner, or else I would have treated him like one. I think that's what Paul is saying here. And if I'm right in that, then of course what little evidence of Paul's feeling that he ought to have turned the other cheek there is completely demolished, isn't there? He is aggressive right to the end. And certainly, as he progresses in his defense, he doesn't seem to me to show any signs of contrition for his aggressive strategy of confrontation. He goes on in exactly the same manner. Verse 6 and 7, knowing that some of them were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he shouts out in the Sanhedrin, my brothers, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, and I stand on trial because of my hope in the resurrection of the dead. And when he said this, a dispute breaks out between them. Now, even those commentators who are prepared to forgive Paul's earlier quick temper find it very hard to excuse this, which they regard as very unprincipled outburst. Who could imagine, they say, a Christian, standing up in a court of law, uttering a half-truth, I am a Pharisee, and then mischievously provoking strife between rival factions in the judiciary? Dean Farrar, a famous Victorian scholar, regards it as very unworthy of the great apostle. We can't imagine Jesus under such circumstances adopting these tactics, he says. Do you know, I really do wonder if such commentators are being fair to Paul. I'd like to suggest this morning that he was totally justified in adopting the aggressive stance he was, both towards the high priest and towards the Sanhedrin council. And that in similar circumstances, we ought to have the guts to do the same. It's all tied up with this issue of the legitimacy of self-defense. Let me say three things about this situation in Paul's favour. The first is this, that those words of Jesus, turn the other cheek, are not, if you read them in the Sermon on the Mount, about self-defence at all. They are prohibiting revenge. And that's a very different thing, isn't it? If you read the words, you'll find they're all part of Jesus' exposition of the Old Testament text, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. In the Old Testament law, that was intended as an instruction to magistrates about how to award damages in the case of criminal assault. The more grievous the injury, the higher the damages, the more severe the penalty. There was to be some degree of proportionality in retribution. That's what it meant. But unfortunately, in the days of Jesus, there were some Jews who wanted to quote this Old Testament law as an excuse for personal vengeance. Something, of course, which the law in its original context was actually designed to prevent by taking vengeance out of the hands of the individual and investing it in the magistrate. But Jesus' response to this abuse of Scripture is to affirm the distinctive Christian ethic of non-retaliation. Don't resist the evil person, he says. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the left. In other words, Christians are not to be vindictive. They are not to be the sort of people who are always seeking vengeance on those who offend them. You don't take revenge on your enemies, he says. On the contrary, you are tolerant, you are generous, you are even loving towards your enemies, says Jesus in that passage. But, and here's the balance, you see, which Paul amply illustrates for us in Acts 23. There is all the difference in the world between being easygoing and being a doormat. There is all the difference in the world between not standing on your rights and between and acting as if you had none to stand on. Truth is, of course, that Paul had been physically attacked on any number of occasions by Jews. We read about many of them, and many more there are which we're not told about. And it's clear that as a Roman citizen and as a person of considerable rhetorical skill, he could have pressed charges for assault in the Roman courts against those who had injured him. And he might have had a good chance of scoring points off them. There were many occasions when the Christians outnumbered the Jews. And if Paul had wanted to, he could have roused his supporters to give them some very bloody noses. But in point of fact, we never find Paul taking the Jews to court. We never find Paul rousing his supporters to give them a bit of aggro in return. Why doesn't he do that? Well, because he knew as well as we know Christ's ethic of non-retaliation. Do not repay evil for evil. Those are his words, written only a few, perhaps less than a year before this in the Epistle to the Romans. Paul had in fact turned the other cheek towards his Jewish brothers dozens of times during his missionary career, and it's quite unfair to complain that he doesn't. If his response is different on this occasion, then, it's not because he had at length come to the end of his patience. It is because in some way this situation was substantially different. How was it different? I'll tell you. He was under arrest. That's how it was different. This was not a case of seeking personal vengeance. This was a case of conducting a legal defense, of answering charges. The appropriate text of Jesus in this situation was not turn the other cheek at all, but render to Caesar. And that brings us to the second thing I want to say on Paul's behalf in this situation. It is a Christian duty to see justice done in the courts. Now look more carefully at what he actually says to the high priest. God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. You sit there to judge me according to the law, yet you yourself violate the law by commanding that I be struck. Now it's quite clear, you see, from what Paul wrote in Romans 13. Just a little earlier, as I say, than this incident here, that he regarded as a God-given function of all government to protect the innocent and to punish the guilty. He had a very high view of government. In fact, he regarded it as the government's duty to fulfill the wrath of God, to exact vengeance on the wrongdoer, so that the individual didn't have to do it. You're not to seek revenge, he said. Leave room for the wrath of God. And where is the wrath of God found, he says? Well, the wrath of God is found, at least partly, in the sword of the civil governor, who is mandated by God to execute his wrath on the wrongdoer. If you read Paul's argument in Romans 12 and 13, you'll discover that's the point he's making, that it's the government's job to take retribution on evil men and to protect the innocent. And so it is a consistent feature of Paul's life that whenever he has dealings with civil authorities, he insists that they do their job right. There's an absolutely splendid example of it at Philippi in Acts chapter 16, when Paul and Barnabas are flogged on the orders of the local magistrates. Now, it was illegal to flog Paul and Barnabas because they were both Roman citizens. So when they're released from the cells the next morning, after having converted the jailer and his family, incidentally, the night before, but when they're released the next morning from the cells, Paul insists that these magistrates themselves come down to the prison and offer a public apology for the way they had been treated. He wouldn't allow the incident to be swept under the carpet. We see something a little bit similar in Acts 22, last week, asserting his civil rights in a similar way, avoiding a flogging on the grounds of his Roman citizenship, telling the Roman commander, you can't do that. It's not legal. It's clear, you see, Paul did not believe there was anything moral or spiritual about allowing judicial maladministration to pass without protest. Turn the other cheek simply wasn't spoken in a courtroom situation. In fact, to have a passive, weak-kneed approach to corrupt authorities, far from being an example of Christian witness, would in fact be a defection from Christian civil duty. Let me look again at verse 3 and you see what he's saying. You hypocrite, what right have you got to try me when you flout proper legal procedure yourself? That's what he's saying. If you do that, God will smite you. If you put yourself above the law, God will judge you. What Paul is protesting in verse 3 is not then his own pride, but he's protesting about due process of law. It was illegal to interrogate a witness under duress in a Jewish court. According to Jewish law, a man was innocent until he was proven guilty. Paul's indignation is not so much because he'd been struck. He'd been struck thousands of times, probably. No, his protest was because he'd been struck in a court of law where justice ought to prevail, and that he would not tolerate. And neither should we. And that brings us to the third thing I'll say on his behalf in this situation. Paul is not here simply defending himself, though he has a right to do that. He is also defending the gospel. And that, I'm sure, is the explanation for the outburst in verse 6. Had he been up before the council for parking his chariot on a double yellow line, I suspect you would have found Paul much less belligerent in mood, even though he was convinced he was innocent of the charges. He certainly wouldn't have spoken out as he does in verse 6. The reason he makes this great outburst, my brothers, I am the Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, is quite simply in order to bring out into the open the real reason he was on trial, which was not because of his riotous behavior at all, but because of his Christian faith. Just picture the situation. There is Claudius Lysias standing in the corner with his troops around him. He's suspicious that these Christians are dangerous, a threat to the civil peace. There's the Sanhedrin gathered all around, the 70 elders of Judah. A substantial number of them are convinced that Christians are heretics and ought to be outlawed. What Paul's gesture in the courtroom is designed to prove, you see, is that this was not so. Christians are not criminals. They are not hereticals. They are simply controversial. That's all Christians are. Now, you may feel Paul was stretching a point a little to say, I am a Pharisee. And of course he was. It isn't a half-truth at all. There was nothing in his Pharisaism, at its best, that he had to abandon in order to become a Christian. If he'd been a Sadducee, it would have been different. For Sadducees, like the new Bishop of Durham, didn't believe in resurrections. They were anti-supernaturalists. But a Pharisee did. Once a Pharisee was convinced that Jesus was indeed the Messiah and the kingdom of God had arrived, he could embrace Christianity as the fulfillment of his Jewish faith with no serious theological embarrassment at all. And Paul himself had done so. Clearly he didn't regard himself as having to abandon his Pharisaic roots. The Old Testament was still his Bible. The God of Israel was still his God. And on those grounds, he believed he ought to be able to enjoy exactly the same legal recognition and legal protection under Roman law as any other representative of Jewish orthodoxy did. That was his case. And to a very large extent, his courtroom device succeeded in proving his case. For it's clear, you see, that as a result of it, Claudius Lysias became convinced that Paul didn't belong to a criminal organization. And he says so in his letter, doesn't he, down in chapter 23, verse 29. I found the accusation had to do with questions about their law, but there was no charge against him that deserved death or imprisonment. Claudius Lysias realized that as a result of what happened in the Sanhedrin. What's more, it's clear that as a result of Paul's outburst, some, at least within the Sanhedrin, came to Paul's theological defense. Some of the teachers of the law who were Pharisees stood up and argued vigorously, we find nothing wrong with the man. I suggest this was a vital and an important victory that Paul scored, albeit by unconventional methodology in the courtroom. At least some Romans and some Jews now would listen to the Christian message with less prejudice as a result of his demonstration that there was nothing politically seditious or theologically novel about it. Christianity was just controversial. And nothing more. If it be a crime to be a Christian, then there were some in the Sanhedrin itself who also ought to be in the dock. The legitimacy of Christian self-defense, then. It's a truth I think we need to hold in balance with that ethic of non-retaliation which Jesus lays upon us. Far from being a reprehensible lap into unchrist-like belligerence, I think Paul's action in this chapter is totally in line with the example of Jesus. God doesn't rebuke it, you see in verse 11. As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome. There's no rebuke from God about the way Paul acted. In fact, if you think about it, Jesus used very similar language in condemnation of the corrupt Jewish establishment of his own day, calling them not merely whitewashed walls, but whitewashed tombs, concealing decaying skeletons behind their cosmetic exteriors, he said. What's more, Jesus too was anxious in his day to disabuse those who wished to interpret him as a theological innovator. Don't think I've come to abolish the law and the prophets, he says. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. And there were times, even in Jesus' life, when the master used quite violent and histrionic methods to get his point across. As when he drove the money changers out of the temple, for instance. Now, turn the other cheek does not mean being a Christian doormat, any more than Jesus himself was a Christian doormat. There's nothing laudable about keeping quiet and submissive when justice is being flouted in the courts, when the reputation of the gospel is at stake, or indeed when we personally are subjected to false charges. I'm reminded of some lines of Dryden, who comments that in this world often, bold knaves thrive without one grain of sense, while good men starve for want of impudence. Perhaps a little more Christian impudence might not go amiss sometimes. Often we are not belligerent enough, I think. The legitimacy, then, of Christian self-defense. That's the first thing I want you to think about coming out of our study passage this morning. And it isn't unconnected with the second thing I want you to think about, the power of plain speaking. Look on to the second trial, the trial before Felix, in chapter 24. 5 days later, the high priest Ananias went down to Caesarea with some of the elders and a lawyer named Tertullus, and they brought their charges against Paul before the governor. I wish we had time to reflect a little bit on the exciting interlude that occupies the last part of chapter 23. Now, quite apart from the atmosphere of espionage that breathes through the assassination plot that we read about there, There's an absolutely tantalizing little insight into Paul's family background, isn't there? That would be fascinating to explore. I wonder if you noticed that as we were reading in verse 16. The son of Paul's sister. Out of the blue, Luke brings that in. So Paul had close family still in Jerusalem. It's a fascinating thought, isn't it? Makes it all the clearer, doesn't it, why leaving Jerusalem was such a wrench for him all those years before. For Christ's sake, I've suffered the loss of all things, he said. And he wasn't just talking about his career. But we haven't got time, I'm afraid, to do more than just note that little sidelight in passing. The upshot of this abortive conspiracy to take Paul's life is that Claudius Lysias decides it was time to pass the buck. If there was going to be any more riots or trouble, then let the provincial governor be held responsible, not him. So he sends Paul off with an armed guard to Felix. And this gem of a covering letter. Did you notice how subtly Claudius bends the truth in it? I rescued him, he says, having learned he was a Roman citizen. Not quite the way it was, as I recall it, but you must judge for yourselves. At least he makes it clear to Felix that the reason he's sending Paul to him is not because he believes he's guilty, but in order to prevent further violence. And that ensured that Paul would be treated with respect by Felix. He wouldn't have to resort to courtroom polemics anymore. There would be no more prejudiced juries. Now, he could rely in Felix's court on the power of plain speaking. And this he does. And the easiest way I think I can demonstrate to you just how plain his words are to compare Paul's defense speech with that of the prosecuting counsel, this professional Latin barrister, Tertullus, whom the Jewish authorities commissioned especially for the occasion. You see, Tertullus is full of fawning flattery. It comes out even in translation, I think. I mean, look at verse 2, for instance, of chapter 24. We have enjoyed a long period of peace under you. Well, that's utter rubbish. Felix's reign had been characterized by the most appalling civil unrest. Your foresight has brought about reforms in this nation. Putting it a little optimistically, Felix is one of the most illiberal and repressive governors they'd ever had. And all the rhetorical flourishes, too. In every way and in every place, or whatever it is in verse 3. That's right, everywhere and in every way. Most excellent, Felix. Notice the aristocratic title. Tertullus knew perfectly well that Felix was not nobly born. He was a commoner with a strong streak of political opportunism and a few relatives in high places. Calling him most excellent was to say the least, a little unctuous. And then in verse 4, another little rhetorical device for impressing the audience. In order not to weary you further, I would request you be kind enough to hear us briefly. In other words, I'll be the least of your problems, Your Honour. It won't be long before you're back at your sherry bottle again if you just let this trivial matter slip by. It was a load of flannel, wasn't it, really? It doesn't have anything to do with the case at all, this introduction. But worse about Tertullus is his downright distortion of the truth, because when he eventually does get round to it, what he does is accuses Paul on 3 counts. And all of them are either utterly fabricated or maliciously slanted. First of all, he accuses him of being politically dangerous. We found this man a troublemaker, a word which strongly would suggest to Felix that this was the sort of character who stirs up civil insurrections. He says he causes riots among the Jews all over the world. Secondly, he accuses him of being a leader of an illegal sect, the sect of the Nazarenes. Probably using that word Nazarene to emphasize the Galilean connection, because Galilee was the center of a lot of insurrection in these days, and uses the word sect in order to suggest that this was not a religion which Rome had granted permission to exist, unlike the Jews. And thirdly, he accuses him of scandalizing the Jewish community by an act of desecration. He even tried to desecrate the temple, he says in verse 6. All 3 of these were damaging misrepresentations. That is not so much a prosecution case as a smear campaign which Tertullus is offering. But I want you to notice how Paul replies. Instead of flattery, we have courtesy. Instead of rhetoric, we have unembroidered simplicity. verse 10. I know that for a number of years you've been judge over this nation, so I gladly make my defense. No waffle about all this peace and reforms, because Paul knew it wasn't true. He was putting his confidence in Felix's judicial experience, not his record as an administrator, nor, come to that, his susceptibility to sycophantic drivel. And instead of unsubstantiated accusations, we find Paul consistently appealing to the evidence. Verse 11, you can easily verify. Verse 13, they cannot prove to you the charges. Verse 19, those Jews from Asia ought to be here before you and bring charges if they have anything against me. And as for the charges themselves, we have a clear and honest account of the facts. One by one, he answers them. First of all, he says, I am not seditious. Verse 12. My accusers did not find me arguing with anyone at the temple or stirring up a crowd in the synagogue or anywhere else in the city. Secondly, he had not desecrated the temple. Verse 17. I was ceremonially clean when they found me in the temple courts. There was no crowd with me, nor was I involved in any disturbance. And thirdly, and most important of all as far as Paul was concerned, he was not the leader of an illegal sect. Verse 14. I worship the God of our fathers as a follower of the way, which they call a sect. But I believe everything that agrees with the law and that is written in the prophets, and I have the same hope in God as these men, that there will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. See, once again, he's trying to prove the same point he had made more dramatically in the Sanhedrin. That Christianity stands in the tradition of Old Testament religion, it is no crime, it is no heresy, and that the Romans ought to accord it the same protection that they do to the Judaistic faith. If Paul had done anything to cause trouble, it was no more than this, and he had affirmed in the Sanhedrin his belief in the resurrection, which many Orthodox Jews also believed in. And if that be a crime or a heresy, then he was guilty. But of all other charges, he pleaded innocent. I think you can see, can't you, that it's a speech in a different tenor and substance from that of Tertullus. It's as different from Tertullus as bread and butter is different from whipped cream. Paul needed no homiletic devices to enhance the credibility of his testimony because he believed in the power of plain speaking. Henry Wotton describes the happy man in an old poem. His armour was his honest thought and simple truth his utmost skill, he says. That's Paul. Honest truth. That's all he relied on. And I want you to notice that Paul's confidence in such an unvarnished presentation of the facts wasn't misplaced. Verse 22. Then Felix, who was well acquainted with the way, adjourned the proceedings. When Lysias the commander comes, he said, I will decide your case. He ordered the centurion to keep Paul under guard, but to give him some freedom and permit his friends to take care of his needs. Felix knew then quite a lot about Christianity already, and he had the commander's letter, which supported Paul's story. Now he had heard Paul's testimony from his own lips. Most judges, I suspect, would have dismissed the case then and there. And the degree of liberty that he affords Paul clearly indicates that he feels the man is not really a criminal. The fact that Paul doesn't release him altogether, I think, has to be attributed to just three things. The first was political expediency. You see in verse 27, he wanted to grant a favour to the Jews. These influential Jews from Jerusalem were bad enemies to make. Felix was a politician first and a judge second. Secondly, financial greed. You see in verse 26, he was hoping Paul would offer him a bribe. Where he thought Paul would get the money from, he doesn't say. But thirdly, there was a third reason why Felix did not dismiss the case against Paul. And that was personal curiosity. Here was a man who, unlike Tertullus and his like, whom I guess Felix had a basin full 12 hours out of most days, he was a man who would actually speak straight from the shoulder, even to a governor. Felix wanted to hear this man a bit more. And so he does. Verse 24. Several days later, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was a Jewess. He sent for Paul and listened to him as he spoke about faith in Christ Jesus.
I think it's worth commenting, just in passing, that when he was giving his earlier speech in court, formally before Felix, Paul did not try to turn that into an evangelistic address. Of course, some Christians would have done, wouldn't they? Some Christians interpret buying up every opportunity to mean evangelizing people on every occasion, no matter how inappropriate or rude. We're not short in the church of Christian boors who think the only sort of witness that counts is to shout in people's ears as often as possible, "Believe in the Lord Jesus and you'll be saved." But Paul wasn't so short-sighted or stupid as that. He understood the importance of the right opportunity before he'd been on trial in the courtroom. And Christian integrity demanded that his words there be directly related to the charges he faced. He wasn't there to preach a sermon, he was there to answer charges. It wasn't his place then to try and turn the proceedings into a gospel meeting. But on this second occasion, it was different. Felix had asked him to explain the Christian faith, and Paul was not a man who needed two invitations to do that. What I want you to notice again, though, is that in this second context, this more informal context, Paul still believes in the power of plain speaking. Verse 25. As Paul discoursed on righteousness, self-control, and judgment to come, Felix was afraid and said, "That's enough for now." Some of you know that a few weeks back we had the Queen visit us here, and yours truly had to hold her in conversation for a minute or two. I freely confess I was a little overawed by that occasion. It isn't easy to speak straight from the shoulder to people of high rank. Instinctively, we moderate the way we express things because we don't want to cause offence, don't we? But Paul, it seems, believed that there was a limit to Christian tact, even when it comes to royalty. Certain aspects of the Christian message, though unpopular, were non-negotiable, and he would not dilute them, even when he was talking to a governor. And one of those unpalatable but necessary aspects of Christian truth was the doctrine of sin. You see the three subjects he was expounding on? Righteousness. That is, the standards God demands in human behavior. Self-control, that is the discipline God expects in human behavior. And thirdly, judgment to come, that is the sanction God imposes on human behavior. It's not surprising Felix was disturbed by Paul's candid exposition of these things. He was a corrupt ruler for a start. Righteousness had not been his strong point. He was a self-indulgent ruler for a second. Drusilla was his third wife, and he was living in adultery with her. Self-control hadn't been his strong point. He was an insecure ruler, third, living in a place where Roman governors didn't always live long. He wasn't sure judgment to come was going to be his strong point either. Can it have been pleasant for him to reflect on how he would stand when the time came for him to exchange the role of magistrate for that of the accused, and stand himself before God's bar of justice? And there can be little doubt, I suppose, that Paul was taking a risk in addressing his governor so frankly on so sensitive a point, but he does so, courageously, and not without effect. Felix was afraid, and said, "That's enough for now." You see what I mean about the power of plain speech? There are two lessons I want to suggest to you before we go we need to learn from these concluding verses of our passage. The first is a lesson for Christians. We mustn't be afraid to speak plainly to people in all situations, but particularly, we mustn't be afraid to speak plainly to people about sin. The problem with a lot of evangelism is it talks about everything else except sin these days. It speaks to the young about their need to find purpose in life. It speaks to the sick about their need to find healing. It speaks to the poor about their need to find justice. It speaks to the clever about their existential despair. It speaks to the bereaved about their need to find hope beyond the grave. It's all perfectly legitimate. But the danger is, you see, that in exploiting all these felt needs, we neglect the one need which all human beings, without exception, have. The need for forgiveness. Jesus Christ did not come into the world in order to save men from adolescent boredom, or drug dependency, or existential despair, or the fear of death. Deliverance from our subjective neuroses and anxieties is not the real rescue the gospel is talking about. The real rescue is an objective one and a moral one. Salvation from judgment to come. And so often we are afraid to make that plain to people, aren't we? We mustn't be. The second lesson is a lesson for any non-Christian here. And I know there are a few. If Christians mustn't be afraid to speak plainly about sin, the lesson for you, I suggest, from these verses is that you mustn't be afraid to think plainly about sin. Felix was, you see. He couldn't take it, could he? "Enough of that, preacher," he said. "You're giving me indigestion." And that's the way countless people evade the unpleasant truths that the Bible presents before them. They resist it. "I'm not going to that church again," they say. They dismiss it. Hellfire and judgment nonsense, they say. And most of all, perhaps, they postpone it. Some other time, perhaps. "I'm very busy right now." And the reason is always the same. Because deep down, like Felix, they're afraid. It's a knee-jerk response to deep anxiety about their guilty state and their ultimate destiny. Anxieties they would rather run away from than face up to. But I am telling you this morning, you've got to face up to these things. Sooner or later, you will have to face up to the issues of righteousness and self-control and judgment to come. But you know you're morally responsible. He's not going to surprise you when you stand before God to give account for your life. You're already expecting it, aren't you? So don't blame the preacher if he speaks plainly about it to you too. You must be willing to think about it. For if you don't think about it now and find the Savior, who alone can deliver you from those fears, then the Bible asserts you will have all eternity to think about these things and rue your foolish neglect and procrastination. You see what we read in verse 26? He sent for Paul frequently. 2 years passed. Can you imagine it? This governor was there with Paul in prison, and every now and again he would pull him out and talk to him a bit more. Over 2 years, again and again, he had Paul the Apostle there, telling him about righteousness and self-control and judgment to come. But every time the reaction was the same. "Yeah. Enough of this. Come again another day." Is that your reaction? I dare to suggest that it's been the reaction of some of you for far too long. There's a little poem on the clock in Chester that goes like this. "When as a child I laughed and wept, time crept. When as a youth I dreamt and talked, time walked. When I became a full-grown man, time ran. Later on, I older grew. Time flew. Soon, I shall find, while travelling on, time gone." And then there's a question. Will Christ have saved my soul by then? Let's pray together.